Good evening and welcome to your magnificent Palladium Theater. It's a joy, and a privilege, and a pleasure to be here. You should be indeed very proud of this magnificent theater. Tonight's program has been correctly billed as a keyboard conversation program. And some of you might be wondering, why is there a concert pianist on that stage who's talking to us? Well, a keyboard conversation program is, in essence, a concert. It's a concert with commentary. It's primarily a concert in that each work on the program is performed in its entirety. What we'd like to think of as being the plus is that prior to the performance of each work, I shall speak to you a bit about the piece of music that you are to hear. And I do this with the hope that whatever I say about the composition in advance of your hearing it will make your listening experience to that work more meaningful, more focused, more accessible, more enjoyable. Louis Moreau Gottschalk was the most celebrated American composer of the first half of the 19th century. The most celebrated American composer of the second half of the 19th century was unquestionably Edward MacDowell. We know MacDowell today by a very occasional performance of his heroic second piano concerto, but unquestionably, the most famous, most beloved single piece of MacDowell's is a short work he wrote for the piano in 1896 that he titled To a Wild Rose. And this piece of music almost did not survive. MacDowell wrote it one morning, didn't like it, and chucked it in the wastebasket. Later that afternoon, Mrs. MacDowell, a trained musician herself, happened to see the manuscript, looked at it, and she realized the musical quality of that which she saw. And she begged her husband to reconsider. Instead of having the piece perish, it should be published. He listened to his wife, the work was published, and the composition became world famous. And it's Mrs. MacDowell who we have to thank for it. I must tell you that this particular story is a favorite of my wife's. This very tender composition seems to evoke a past age of greater simplicity and of peace. Very welcome in our troubled times. To a Wild Rose from the year 1896 by Edward MacDowell.
Music of Edward MacDowell, the very popular To a Wild Rose, performed by pianist Jeffrey Siegel, who is our guest today here on Crossover, and explains to us his successful series of keyboard conversations. The new season of Keyboard Conversations opens at the Kimmel on Monday, October 27th, and it will feature Gershwin, George Gershwin, and some of his best friends. I am delighted today to welcome a very, very fine musician and a very interesting person who is contributing greatly to the to music and presenting music to people that are love music but may not be musicians. Jeffrey Siegel, welcome to Crossover.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back again.
Now, of course, that's kind of confusing, something that I just said. But what you do is you not only are a very fine musician, but you bring music to people that don't understand music but love it.
I'm very happy to say that the keyboard conversations, the solo concert with commentary programs that I do in Philadelphia and in many other cities throughout the United States, the audiences for these programs are made up of people, Jill, who are seasoned subscribers to the Philadelphia Orchestra, avid music lovers. But thankfully, the programs also reach out to people of who are of all ages, who are not, shall we say, avid music lovers yet, but they know they're missing something not to have Beethoven in their life. And they're looking for what a friend of mine called a gentle inoculation into the joys of classical music.
Well, people are intimidated. You know, they say, oh, I don't know anything about music. Mm-hmm. You know, so what am I? But what you do is you present it in such a way, you're not condescending, but you are knowledgeable. And I think that you are very well received because you open up a world to people who really just have no other access to
it. Well, when one thinks about it, we're living today, and you and I have discussed this before, we are living today in the most impersonal, robotic, computerized society there has ever been.
Yep.
And theoretically, what great music has to offer a thinking, feeling human being is more necessary now than ever before. But as I don't need to tell you, so many cuts of funding for the arts in this country, particularly music, make it very, very difficult to be able to provide the love of music, the gift of music, to one's fellow human being. And the series that I do at the Kimmel Center is now in its 10th anniversary season, but it's actually produced by Friends of the Keyboard Conversation series. It's a group of people who care deeply about these programs continuing, who give very generously of their time and money.
And I might say that Jeffrey Siegel knows of what he speaks because he is a distinguished pianist. Tell us a little bit about your background, Jeff.
Well, I've played many White Tie and Tails concerts, particularly in this city, as the privileged soloist with your great orchestra. Started with Mr. Ormandy, actually, and I've also worked with Charlie Dutoit and many others. But these keyboard conversations, Jill, have really taken over my life. I do them now as an ongoing series in 21 different cities, including London, England, with my Chicago accent. And I think there's a tremendous need, more than ever, I think, for a concert with commentary. As you know, every work on the program is performed straight through. What we like to think of as the plus is that I speak to the audience a bit about the music prior to performing each piece. And hopefully, as a result of what I've said and some of the musical demonstrations I make out of context, when I sit down to play the piece through, the audience feels like they're on the inside track and the listening is rewarding and enriching and accessible.
Now, you, your credentials are stellar. I mean, you're a Steinway artist. You studied with Rosina Levine, so that puts you in a category all by yourself because she only accepted certain students, and we knew that at Juilliard. So, but aside from that, you have performed with orchestras all over the world. A very, very full concert schedule, I would imagine, before you got involved with the keyboard conversations, because I'm sure that this, too, takes you around. Is it around the world or just around the country?
Well, I don't really speak any language other than English, and though I've been invited to give the programs in other cities outside of the where English is not the first language, I'm reluctant. Also, as my wife has reminded me, I have 95 concerts on my my schedule this season, which, as she says, is enough for a man, particularly my age.
Well, we don't just talk because as you get older, you get better.
I hope so.
And you're in very good company.
But I have an interesting story regarding Leonard Bernstein to share with you.
Sure.
He was really, Jill, the guiding light for me in doing these programs. And in 1988, I was soloist with the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center with Zubin Mehta conducting.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Bernstein was there the same week conducting his own music. And so we were seeing quite a bit of one another. And one morning I walked in and he says, I want to talk to you, Jeffrey. He said, what are these keyboard conversations that you do? I've been reading about them. I've been hearing from Maggie Carson, my publicist, about this. Why do you talk about music? This coming from him. And I began to tell him, he says, "What if you're going to do the Rhapsody in Blue of Gershwin, what would you say about it?" And I started giving him my spiel, and Jill, the smile on his face got larger and larger as I'm giving him my spiel.
Well, with new material that he could use.
He said, "I see where you got this idea." Yeah. And he knew it was from him. And then he said something I'll never forget. "Look," he said, "Jeffrey, I know it's great to be solos with the Philharmonic, White Tie entails and so on. These keyboard conversations are the most important work that you're doing, and you really need to concentrate on this because the need for it is great." And that's the last time I saw him, and this was 1988.
Oh, my goodness.
And now to some music of Leonard Bernstein. It's difficult to believe that Mr. Bernstein is not around anymore. He was such a super colossal force on the international musical scene, particularly as a composer and a conductor and a music educator. He was a renowned musical figure. As a composer, we know him best by his big theater pieces, West Side Story and Candide, also his works for large symphony orchestra. What's not generally known is that Mr. Bernstein composed some short pieces for his instrument, for the piano. He wrote them throughout his life, and he called them anniversaries. They were musical tributes to people who were close to him. And we're going to hear four of these very brief anniversaries, and to my way of thinking, these anniversaries show us a much more intimate, more deeply personal side of this very extrovert personality. The first of these anniversaries is to Aaron Copland, a friend and composer whom Mr. Bernstein greatly admired. And Mr. Bernstein asked that this piece be played with great simplicity. The second of these anniversaries is to Elizabeth B. Ehrman. Humphrey Burton, Bernstein's biographer, told me that Elizabeth B. Ehrman was the mother of a college classmate of Bernstein's from his Harvard days. And she must have been a rather saucy, spicy personality. The next anniversary is for Felicia, Mr. Bernstein's wife, and it's a double anniversary. 6th of February was her 52nd birthday and the 27th anniversary of their wedding. And the fourth one is to Helen Coates in memoriam. Who was Helen Coates? She was Mr. Bernstein's first piano teacher in Boston. She went on to be his private secretary. Four anniversaries of Leonard Bernstein: Aaron Copland, Elizabeth B. Ehrman, his wife Felicia, and Helen Coates in memoriam. Thank you.
Well, now, when did you actually start getting the keyboard conversations? Because you were still concertizing. I mean, you had a career in music.
Right. The longest running series is the one in Chicago, my native city, and we're in year 45 at Northwestern University, and I give four programs a year there. And I have people in the audience, again, like here, who are symphony subscribers and people of all ages who have never been to a concert, whether you're talking about a 10-year-old or a senior citizen who's decided the time has come. So it's been very gratifying work, I must
say. Okay, so do you have in your audience people that know something about music but are a little bit puzzled with the more contemporary music? Do you ever touch on that? Because that, too, is, I mean, we've gone through various eras already. Mm. You know, even the contemporary music has changed. So
right.
I just wonder, do you touch on that at all, if there is a need, you know, to explain it? I mean, if it's in the program or you feel that you want to expose people to
that? Yeah, it depends how you define contemporary. When I think of the contemporary composers I have played, Henri Dutilleux, who've perhaps become even classic in our time, to say nothing of people I actually played their compositions for and learned from, Aaron Copland, Samuel Barber, Leonard Bernstein. I don't know if we'd call them contemporary anymore, but I do play the music of these composers on various programs, and I do talk about what's a discord in a harmony, what's a complex rhythm where it's not exactly a march or exactly a waltz. And the program coming up, which opens our 10th anniversary season at the Kimmel Center, is going to be an interesting one because it's called Gershwin and Friends.
And you'll have a sellout, I'm sure.
Well, it's accessible and attractive program. It's going to have, Jill, the solo piano version, very rarely heard, that Gershwin himself made of Rhapsody in Blue. Now, what's interesting about this, as you know, Rhapsody in Blue is very often criticized for being a sectionalized episodic piece.
But he never made an arrangement of it, I don't think.
He made an arrangement for the solo piano didn't want to carry an orchestra around with him all the time.
Of course.
And there's something to be said. Somebody in the audience once said at the Q&A at the end of the program where I played Rhapsody in Blue, I just feel I've heard a black and white version of something I've always heard in color. And I see it differently and hear it differently without the orchestra. We're going to talk about why this is not such an episodic, sectionalized piece and how well Gershwin composed it. Also, the origin of the piece, that he only had 3 weeks to do it, and it was a surprise that he had to do it, etc. But also on the program, and I'm very happy to share this, we're going to have the Philadelphia premiere of an unpublished piano piece of no other than Leonard Bernstein.
Wow.
It's called Meditation on a Wedding. Mm. And how do I happen to be the lucky fellow who was given a photocopy of the original manuscript and the permission from the Bernstein estate to play the piece? I will share all of that with the audience, as well as they're hearing some published works of Bernstein, which are off the beaten track and show a different side of this very public composer. We're also going to have a very humorous piece of Aaron Copland's, his first published piece, called The Cat and the Mouse.
Oh, okay.
And it's a terrific piece.
And now some music of Aaron Copland, who was rightfully thought of as the dean of the American composers in the 20th century. And we're going to hear Aaron Copland's first published composition, a work he wrote as a teenager. And the title of the composition is The Cat and the Mouse. And as you might expect, there's going to be a lot of chase music in this piece, a lot of scampering quickly up and down the keyboard, for example. There are also moments where the action slows down. In one particular place, Mr. Copland writes into the score the word sinister. And we have the impression from the music he writes that the cat is sneaking up upon the mouse, ready to pounce. Mr. Copland gives us some thick, powerful chords which pounce in each octave of the piano, coming to a pause on a low, rather sinister sounding tone in the bass. This is going to be followed by some rather hazy, shadowy harmonies. And this section of the piece, Mr. Copeland asks to be played in a funereal manner. And then comes the end of the piece, a slight little jazz riff, and here Mr. Copeland has written into the score, limping slightly. Rather enigmatic. Does the cat capture the mouse at the end or not? Let's find out. The Cat and the Mouse, Opus 1. Of Aaron Copeland. Let's take a vote. How many of you think that the cat captures the mouse? Raise your hands. And how many of you think that the mouse gets away? Raise your hands. Ah. Well, I didn't want to tell you this before you heard the piece, But Mr. Copeland was inspired to write this piece by a poem of the same title, in which it is an old cat that chases a young mouse. And the old cat catches the young mouse. And is about to eat the mouse when the mouse begins to argue with the cat, coming up with many well-reasoned, rational, logical reasons why the cat should not eat the mouse. And the cat listens to the mouse and then devours the mouse. And the moral of this story is that while youth is hopeful and optimistic and cheerful, old age is merciless.
Music of Aaron Copland, his Opus 1, The Cat and the Mouse, performed by pianist Jeffrey Siegel. And if you'd like to hear more about this, you can go to the first keyboard conversation of the season at the Kimmel Center on October 27th, and Mr. Siegel will enlighten you further. The final two programs of Keyboard Conversations with Jeffrey Siegel will be on January 19th. It's Torment and Triumphs, music of Franz Liszt, and on Monday, March 9th, music of Joyous Celebration. For tickets and further information, you can go to KimmelCenter.org on the web or 215-893-1999. Until next time, I'm Jill Pasternak.